Call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is Friday. It is 1:03 p.m., February 20th, 2015. Present are Representative Klayman, Representative Grunberg, Representative Foster, and co-chair, our Vice Chair Keller, and myself, Representative Ledoux. First item is please turn off your electronic devices. Thank you. We have two new bills and one previously heard today before us. The two new bills are HB 15, an act relating to credits towards a sentence of imprisonment, etc., and HB 83, an act relating to collecting information about civil litigation by the Alaska Judicial Council. Both of these are new bills and will be up first today. And then we will continue our discussion of HB 79, the marijuana bill. The order of business today will be to hear HB 83 first and then HB 15, and then we will finish today with HB 79. And what I mean by finish today is we're not finished with a bill, but that's just the last item on the agenda today. First up, presenting HB 83, is my staffer, Clark Bickford. This is his first time presenting a bill, so everybody please be nice. And I'm going to call a brief at ease and pass the gavel over to my vice chair, Representative Keller, for the duration of our hearing of HB 83. So, brief at ease.
Okay, we're back on line. If you would come up. Introduce yourself for the record and tell us about HB 83.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Clark Bickford, staff to Representative Ledoux, as she stated. Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, I am presenting to you House Bill 83. The bill repeals a 1997 law relating to the collection of information about civil litigation by the Alaska Judicial Council. This is a widely forgotten and ignored practice amongst the legal community. For instance, from 2001 to 2010, only 13% of reports have been filed. It is apparent that the majority of the legal community is in favor of this repeal, along with the Alaska Judicial Council. This bill is necessary, and we urge you to support House Bill 83. Thank you. And I can answer some of your questions, and any more detailed questions, I will call on Suzanne DiPietro from the Alaska Judicial Council, who is with us today in the audience. So,
for the record, Charisse, Representative Millett has joined us, and she was here before you made the presentation. It was before you started, but just for the record, we're all here. So, any questions for the sponsor's representative here? Representative Klayman.
You noted a statistic about compliance from what year, and again, well, what was the compliance in terms of reporting in the most recent statistic, and is there a time when there was greater compliance?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman. Yes, so early on when the statute first passed, there was more compliance from the legal community, and gradually that compliance just dropped dramatically. So as I said, 13% of the reports from 2001 to 2010 were filed, and the exact number is over 177,000 civil cases through the court system during those 9 years, and only 20,000 of those cases were reported.
I'll fill in the question. I assume that there was a legislative intent for the original bill, and do you have information about the history? When we're talking about information about the civil court, it seems like it's worthy to have the data, and so just do you have anything about that? Why was the bill on the books if it was no good, if it's no good now?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Originally, they didn't foresee the, it sounds like they didn't foresee the difficulty getting these lawyers to, you know, send in the information. And it, I don't think the Judicial Council has the resources to, you know, make every single 177,000 cases be reported. But if that's not an answer that you're looking for, I could call Suzanne DiPietro up to the stand, and she could most likely give you a better answer.
Trouble is, she'll pick on me. Suzanne, if you'd come forward, please.
I am muzzling myself.
Shocked.
You too.
So, Suzanne, if you would identify yourself for the record, and just if you would pick it up there. So the implication is then that all these years that you haven't been getting the data, that the budget was not, well, I mean, what happened? I mean, because that was, it's the law, it was, you know, and so anyway, if you would.
So thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Suzanne DiPietro. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council. And just to give you a little history, this was passed as part of tort reform legislation in 1997. And the items in the bill had been recommended by the Governor's Advisory Task Force on Civil Litigation. This task force had been formed the year before after Governor Knowles vetoed tort reform legislation that had passed in 1995 and 96. And the task force had the job of making recommendations of how to improve the efficiency and fairness of civil litigation. And during the course of their deliberations, the members of the task force found that it was very difficult to do that because they had no data about, for example, the size of the average jury verdict in a civil case or the size and amount of an average settlement. They didn't even have information about the percentage of times that a plaintiff would win versus a defendant. And so when the legislation passed, this provision was added, and the idea was that the Alaska Judicial Council would collect this information about the settlement of civil cases and would in that way put together reports so that the legislature could monitor the effects of what it had done in the tort reform legislation, because the legislature was looking for some good outcomes as a result of the reforms it had put in place. And so we did that, and we have issued three reports. The first report was kind of a preliminary report very soon after the statute was passed with some information. But then things got rolling, and we issued our biggest report in 2001. And that was actually had quite a bit of information about the type of things that the legislature was interested in, the amount of the average settlement, you know, that kind of civil data information. And it was a good report. The problem was that it was quite difficult to get the information to make the report. And so the council, for that report, we went to the court case files and we pulled the numbers of the cases that we should have been getting reports for. So the types of, so there are some cases that are excluded. So we went in and we said, what are all the cases that settled during this time period that we should have received a report for? And we got those case numbers, and then we looked and saw what reports did we get, and it was a fraction of the number we should have had. So then we sent letters to all the attorneys or parties who should have, we thought, sent us information who hadn't. And through that process, that as you can imagine was a bit laborious, we were able to achieve about a 50% response rate. And that's the highest response rate that we've gotten, but we felt that it was enough information to put out a report that wouldn't be misleading, and so we did that. And then in the subsequent years, though, without that additional outreach from the Judicial Council, the reporting rate did fall. And I have a little bit of information that's just a teeny bit more current than what Mr. Bickford gave you, but very consistent with what he gave you. So in fiscal year 13, the court system data indicate that there were about 6,113 cases that are of the type that we should have received a settlement report from the parties. during that time, the Judicial Council received only 1,086 reports. So based on our conservative estimate, we're only receiving reports of settlements from about 18% of the cases that really we should be. The problem with that number is that it's really too low to put out a report. In other words, if we were to, so we have all the data. So we've been all these years collecting the data. It comes in via our website. We get a couple of, usually a day, an attorney will send in, actually some of them still do it on paper. They send us written forms, and we enter that data into our website, into our large database. So we have been collecting all this information. We've been taking care of the data. We haven't been doing big analysis, but we've been working on the database. So we have it, but we feel that it's not, it's so small a proportion of what we should have, that we feel it would not be responsible to publish the results because it's only 18% of what we should be getting. And to put out a report based on 18% of the total number of cases could be very misleading. And so that's kind of where we are with the reporting requirement.
I'm going to propose to the committee that that we get all our questions on the table and that we not pass the bill today, that we have time to look. And part of my reasoning for that is the report that you provided with, a 2001 report. I just saw it, and I have no real way of evaluating the value of the data, you know, what we've been missing because I haven't seen this or whatever, and I would just like some time to look it over and form some opinions. But I propose that to the committee, and if there's a difference on that, I want to hear from the sponsor in particular or whatever. And then that brings us back to let's get our questions on the table. And I would like to ask, is it a valid reason to get rid of, generally speaking, get rid of a law if it's difficult to comply with?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I probably can't answer that question directly. What I can say to you is that the Judicial Council has a constitutional responsibility to conduct studies to improve the administration of justice for the legislature. And I sit here ready to conduct any studies that the legislature would like me to conduct. If the legislature is interested in the civil case data information, I will do my best to collect it. However, if the information is not of interest now that the whole tort reform movement has kind of come and gone, if the information is not of interest, then, you know, that's really up to you. I guess what I'm trying to say is we will do our best because that is our job and we want to give you the information that you think you need.
Of course.
Yeah.
A follow-up, I guess, on that would be the implication is that the data isn't valuable if you're bringing this forward and supporting it. And that's what I don't know. You know, I mean, I just but it would seem to me like the information is very valuable and that, you know, without really looking into it, that'd be my first impression. And are you saying that there's information that we do not have because there has been noncompliance?
Correct. Yeah, through Mr. Chairman, yes. With only about 18% of the information available, the information that we should have, that should be given to us, with only about 18% of that actually in our database, there's a lot of information outstanding. And I guess I should also just say, you know, I'm as a representative of the Judicial Council, I'm not really taking a position one way or another. I'm really just here to kind of let you know what the difficulties have been and what we have done and to hear also back from you what you would like us to do.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Ledoux?
Two things. First of all, I'd like to clarify for the record that this bill was not put forth through the Judicial Council. The Judicial Council never came to me and asked for this bill. A number of people from the private bar suggested this bill to me. And then, secondly, I just wanted to ask you, Ms. Pietro, so if we were not to pass this bill, and instead we were to say, Judicial Council, we want this information, what would you need in your budget, considering that we're going through pretty lean financial times, in order to put teeth into the law to require people to report? What would that involve, bottom line money?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I could certainly work that up, but I would agree with your thought that going out and collecting the information the way we did for the 2001 report was quite time-consuming, and it would involve additional resources, and I could certainly, if you were interested, kind of work something like that up, but it was quite a bit of time and effort to do that.
Just follow up. So, but that you went through the records because the attorneys were not submitting the data. What would it take in the way of either law or a budget for somebody to enforce the attorneys submitting the data? Who would be in charge of that even?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think that is the issue. There is really no enforcement mechanism in the law. I certainly don't know what one could be. All I can report to you is that when the Judicial Council sent letters and pleas and reminders to the attorneys, we were able to achieve only a 50% compliance rate. So even with our efforts, we got only about half of what we thought we should have gotten. That's what I know for sure.
Thank you.
Before we go to Representative Klayman, I just want to add that there's another aspect to this. I think the Judicial Council would be able to come up with maybe some incentive ideas, too, that might actually make money and instead of cost money. But in the mix of options, that's one that it was interesting to me. You know, there was no enforcement suggestion coming forward. It was a suggestion. And again, it didn't come from you, but the suggestion is to get rid of the law. And so, Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll probably have a couple of follow-ups. In 1999, I think, when they passed the tort reform legislation, and it had previously been vetoed by Governor Knowles, were there arguments being made at that time about what the data was hopefully going to show about the impact of the tort reform legislation? Can you give us a little history about what there was hope that the research that would come from all this data would tell us or tell the legislature?
Yes, through the chair. So the first question that the task force had was about the size of tort jury verdicts. And the Judicial Council actually did a study of tort jury verdicts that was quite interesting. It's actually an appendix to the report. And when the task force saw that there actually were not very many large tort jury verdicts, they shifted their focus to the idea of settlements. And they said, well, most cases settle anyway, so let's find out how much these cases are settling for. And that was sort of the impetus for the idea of reporting. And the idea was that I believe the hypothesis is that because there are large settlements that are paid out by insurance companies, this impacts the cost of insurance and actually causes the cost of insurance to go up and also the availability of insurance to go down, was the theory. And so part of what the Judicial Council and actually the Division of Insurance were supposed to try to answer with this data is what effect, if any, is the settlement of civil cases and some of the tort reform things like caps on damages and so forth, what effect is that having on the availability of insurance and the cost of insurance?
And what is follow-up for Representative Klayman? What did those studies find?
The Division of Insurance, through the chair, the Division of Insurance has issued, I believe, a couple of reports in their effort to comply with that request and was unable to conclude one way or another.
And further follow-up. So the theory of tort reform was there are these huge jury verdicts that are in the millions of dollars that are driving up everybody's insurance costs, but the studies of jury verdicts in Alaska actually showed that there weren't these huge jury verdicts, and that's public information still available today. Go ahead.
Through the chair, yes, that's correct. In the memo in the report, yes.
And further follow up,
Klayman.
Did the research that was done in the years soon after tort reform show that the settlements were paying these huge settlements that weren't showing up in the jury verdicts, or what did it show about the settlements?
So through the chair, the 2001 report has the most complete information on settlements, and it actually showed not I would characterize it as not all that many large settlements, but you know, I'd have to probably review the data a little more closely.
If I ask a question, then we'll go to, I think Max was.
Yeah, I had some more follow-up, but if you want, if somebody else can take over, I don't have to.
Is it follow-up on the same topic?
It is.
Please continue.
Did the on average, were the settlements higher or lower than the jury verdicts, if you remember?
Through the chair, I actually don't remember that. I'm okay. Sorry. And also just a reminder that we only had 50 for that report, we only had 50% of the data, so we have to keep that in mind when we're talking about it, yeah.
All right. I just want, as a follow-up to the follow-up here has been going on, yeah. The description of the settlement and the judgment is only one aspect of what was to be reported. And the other things that will be erased if we do this is information about the court civil justice processes, case processing information, characteristics of the litigation and the parties. Like, for example, to me, not really understanding, I would be very interested on how many of the cases, civil cases, were frivolous, you know, and that's the kind of information that I can't get. You probably know how much court time is taken up in civil litigation. What percentage do you know right off the top of your head? No, but maybe you could bring that back to us. It'd be really interesting to know, you know, and what you'd base that on, you know, without this kind of data is interesting to me. So we have Representative Grunberg and then Representative Ledoux.
If I may ask a few questions.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But go through the chair, because just keep
through
the order.
You.
Yeah.
Okay. These are all through you. Yeah. To Representative Ledoux, we have a CS. Do you want me to make a motion for us to have that before us? At this point for discussion,
yes.
I move that we take up as the bill the H version, which is dated 2/5/15. The work order is 29LS0414/H for discussion.
See no objection. It's before us for discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next, I have several questions, I think, for Ms. DiPietro and then some for Ms. Mead. I believe that the Chair, Representative Keller, asked what would be the enforcement mechanism, somebody asked. And am I not correct, and this could be for either of you, that the enforcement mechanism is if you violate a civil rule in a statute, that could be considered grounds for discipline, right?
Through the chair, that's my understanding. Attorney discipline. Discipline, you mean discipline through the Bar Association?
Yeah.
That's correct. Remembering, of course, that if this also applies to unrepresented litigants.
But for the lawyers, anyway.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay, number two. Ken Jacobus, in his supporting letter, which is in the file, mentions that that this costs the attorneys time, and most plaintiffs' lawyers are on a contingency in PI cases, but the defense bar is not, and they're generally on an hourly basis, and so the clock would run to the clients for the preparation of these reports through the chair, right?
Through the chair, correct.
Do you have any idea how much time would be spent generally filling out one of these things, and we can figure the hourly rate? Because I don't want to see the defense bar lose a dime.
Through the chair, we did streamline the form to make it as easy as possible. And so I can't really answer your question other than to say we tried to get the minimum amount of information in the best way possible. I can add that I have had an email from a law firm suggesting that this was a burden.
Of course
I'll
not.
Follow up, Representative Gruber?
Of course not. It's more money. I appreciate that. The next question I have is really for Ms. Mead, although Ms. DiPietro may be able to mention this, if the members would look at the bill, it repeals certain rules of court. And my recollection is that the protocol in, and this is a matter of comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y.
Not D-Y.
That too.
Yeah.
That normally when you're dealing with the change of a court rule, what we often do in matters of this type would be to request the court system to repeal its rule. And I would just ask, maybe Ms. Mead at the appropriate time, unless Ms. DiPietro wants to ask it, would the protocol normally be to simply request the court system?
Through the chair, I probably couldn't answer about the protocol. I could say that, and I should have said in my original remarks, that the rules requiring an attorney to certify that he or she has submitted the information to the Judicial Council were promulgated as a way to implement the statute. But I could certainly defer to Ms. Mead on the other question.
Mr. Chair, at the appropriate time, I would ask that.
Right. Okay. We'll the question coming there, and I see that Nancy's listening back there, so we're okay there. But we'll finish the questions, if we could, for the Judicial Council first. Is there anything else for the sponsor or the Judicial Council? Representative Ledoux?
So when this law was enacted requiring the reporting, this was after tort reform legislation had been enacted.
Through the chair, that is correct.
So how would you do a study when you just have the information after, as opposed to before? I mean, usually studies will study something before, and then you take some medicine, and then they'll see whether the medicine works, etc. So I guess I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Through the chair, that's exactly correct. We don't have what we would call the baseline data or information. And so we would not be able to say, well, before tort reform, settlements were a certain amount, and after tort reform, they were a certain amount. I think part of the thinking was that we would be able to say, well, right after tort reform, things were a certain way, and then 5 years later these things had changed, and then 10 years later these things had changed. But again, it would be, you know, that would not be the type of analysis that could really prove a causation. That would just be a correlation.
Thank you.
I've got one. The part of the other Judicial Council responsibility is making recommendations for judges, as we all know. Representative Grunberg just pointed out that the violation here would be grounds for discipline. I was wondering if any of these non-compliant attorneys have become judges in the last. We could maybe check on that just to be, you know, I don't want to make a huge point of it. But
how about the compliant judge?
Mr. Chairman, I actually don't know the answer to that question.
Thanks. Any other questions for the Judicial Council or the sponsor? Well, go ahead. Representative Clayman.
This may be more a question for Ms. Mead, but I know that part of the rule was amending the either the court rules or the attorney rules relating to attorney-client privilege and whether or not disclosing this information violated the attorney-client privilege, particularly relating to settlements. And has anyone ever, and I know there was a explicit part in either the bar rule, or not the bar rules, but the attorney's ethics rules or the court rules allowing a waiver of the attorney, that this was not a violation of attorney-client privilege, but did anyone ever, to your knowledge, did anyone ever test that question in court, or have you heard people, lawyers, that were unwilling to report because despite the change in the rules, they still believe it's an attorney-client violation and refuse to provide the information?
So through the chair, no, to my knowledge, nobody has ever challenged that in court. And to the other, I have heard that some attorneys object to the idea of disclosing the information on that ground, but that's really just hearsay.
All right. And then one other follow-up, and one of the questions Representative Keller asked had to do with sitting judges and when they were in practice that would have required them to comply, which of course isn't all the sitting judges. Would there be any way to determine whether they had complied every time, or would you only be able to determine that they had at least sometimes submitted information, or never? Or is that even accessible on your database?
Through the chair, I'm thinking of how we could do that. It would be difficult. We would really have to go back to the court again and get all the list of cases that had been dismissed or settled, and then go and look and see who the attorneys were, and then look and see in our database, did we get anything for them? That would be quite the tricky research project.
What I'll do is I'll let you work that out, whether or not you want that information. As far as my question, it was frankly a rhetorical question, because I don't think that, I think it was ignored. But that, if you want to disprove that, bring us the information back. Did you have one last question before we go to the courts?
Just kind of a response to what Representative Klayman was mentioning. I just call the committee's attention to subsection B of ASO 9.68.130, which is the act that will be the statute that will be repealed under the bill. And that sentence, the initial sentence, says the information received by the council under A, which is all the information, is confidential, period. This restriction does not prevent the disclosure of summaries and statistics in a manner that does not allow the identification of particular cases or parties. And I know that a lot of civil cases, when they settle, are confidential, but I don't think that they're confidential to the extent that we're dealing with here, which is really statistical. And that was just a comment. It wasn't a question.
Nancy, if you come up, and I believe Representative Grunberg has a question he'll restate to you. And then when that's done, or with this questioning, we'll try to get the gavel back to the chair to continue on with the meeting. Representative Grunberg, would you restate the question you had for Nancy?
Yes, Ms. Mead, and you probably have to identify yourself on the record. My vague recollection is that when the legislature has done stuff like this, often it's put in the form of a request to the court. And I'm just talking about the rule change. We repeal the underlying statute with a request to the court that they conform their rules. Is there either way that the court would, and it probably it's not a big deal, but, you know, I don't want to do something that's not done proper and with respect for a co-equal branch of government. Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, and first for the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I think as committee members know, the legislature does have the right to change court rules of practice and procedure by the requisite majority constitutionally, and that happens, in my experience, several times per session at least, and that is an appropriate exercise of the legislature's authority. Almost always I look at that and work with the staff and the sponsor's office on the appropriateness of that from the court's point of view, and but it's done, and it's fine that the legislature does that. And in this instance, as Ms. DiPietro testified, those rules are in the Alaska Rules of Court only solely because of the statute that the legislature passed. So should that statute be repealed, it would not be problematic from the court's point of view to have those court rules also repealed.
One more.
Please. Another one.
I believe if we were to make it so it was simply a request to the court, it wouldn't be a rule change and wouldn't require a two-thirds vote.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, it's my understanding that the legislative legal folks who deal with statutory changes always check to see if there would at least be an indirect rule amendment, if not a direct one, and it's their call as to whether statutory changes do impact rules.
Okay. We'll have to check on that.
Okay. So with that, we're going to go to public testimony, and we can anticipate the bill coming back for us at the sponsor discretion. So, Brewster Jameson, are you online?
Yes, I am.
You have testimony for us. Identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. This is an interesting issue. My name is Brewster Jameson. I am an attorney with Lane Powell. I've been an attorney practicing civil litigation for 31 years in the state. I am a member of the Civil Rules Committee. I'm also a member of the Federal Local Civil Rules Committee. The history of this provision is, I think, somewhat lost in the mist of time. But what I can tell you in practice is it doesn't seem to really accomplish much in the way of useful information, and it does provide or place a burden on practitioners that is, and I heard someone, I couldn't identify who, indicate that that perhaps the defense bar gets billable hours as a result of this law, and I can tell you my practice, I can't speak for all members of the defense bar, my practice is we don't bill for filling out this form. But the information is often is delayed information, or it's information that's not reflective of the actual resolution of the case. For instance, the attorney's fees that are incurred are, I usually put them in as of the date that the form is filed, though there's often a lag between the date that they're, that the form is filed and the final bill, so you don't really get a good picture of the actual fees that were incurred, at least on the defense side. And in terms of settlement information, you get a very limited picture of settlements. You get settlements of cases that are in the court system. You don't get settlements of cases that are settled before they go to court. And I would suggest that a substantial portion of cases, civil cases, in particular very serious civil cases, are settled prior to actually going into court. And those don't need to be reported because they don't involve any court action. They are settled by a release and by payment. I was actively involved in the tort reform movement. I was in favor of tort reform. The majority of my practice over the years has been on behalf of defendants. I had principled reasons why I believed in tort reform, and I believe that it has accomplished a lot of what it set out to accomplish, and it certainly is has a significant impact on my practice in terms of the certainty that it has brought in certain areas that were uncertain before the passage of tort reform, and it's made it easier to settle cases and easier to resolve them and easier to predict outcomes because of things like damage caps and a higher burden of proof for punitive damages, etc. That being said, I don't think that this provision has ever really provided any very useful information, not only because you can't compare it to the baseline, but also there are many confounding factors that have served to change the character and the amount of settlements. There's all sorts of medical inflation. There are many other things, many other factors that go into what cases settle for and what juries award in the way of verdicts. And I would also say that jury verdicts are now by far, in civil cases, the rarity, the exception. It's well known in the civil arena that we have a vanishing civil trial. We just don't see civil cases go to trial any longer. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's maybe a bad thing for some lawyers who charge by the hour. But it is a fact. And so verdicts really don't tell much of the story about the administration of civil justice because the vast majority of civil cases happen outside of the action is really outside of the court system, and the resolution of those cases is done by parties either mediating with the aid of a mediator or by agreement between the parties. So I think there's also a self-selection bias. Whatever data is collected, you have practitioners like me and my office that do comply, and the very fact that we do comply and others don't, I imagine that introduces some kind of bias into the data that is collected. And I don't sense that there's much in the way of a movement to keep this information flow. not only because it's expensive and difficult to collect, but because it doesn't tell us much about the cases. And even if it tells us what it tells us, we're not sure that it can tell us something useful about whether tort reform was or was not good, should or should not continue, or is not fair or unfair. I mean, it's not telling us much useful information. So I'm a believer in limited government, and I think that that's the right way to view government. And, you know, when the government wants to intrude on private individuals and ask them to do something affirmatively, and perhaps incur expense, take time, comply with regulation, that sort of thing, there has to be a really good purpose, a really good reason. But I haven't seen a really good reason for keeping this particular requirement in effect. And for that reason, I fully support the repeal of this provision, and I support the bill that is before you for discussion now. I'm happy to accept any questions or answer any questions that the committee might have, and thank you for your time.
Yeah, I don't see any questions, and I really thank you for your helpful testimony. Thank you very much. Ken Jacobus?
Are you able to hear me?
Ken? Ken Jacobus, last time, try here.
I'm here, but am I coming across now?
Now we got you, loud and clear. Identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony, please. Thanks.
Okay, my testimony will be pretty brief because you've gotten what I've submitted in writing. I'm Ken Jacobus. I've been a practicing attorney in Alaska, both plaintiffs and defense, appellate and trial, since 1969. The repeal of this is something I've been trying to work on for 10 years because I agree with Mr. Jamieson, and I also will agree with Sarah Batten, who's going to be testifying after me. This doesn't really give us any additional information that's useful. What was done with the information before, let me back up a second, before the idea of tort reform, there's been an assumption that verdicts were too high, that attorneys were getting paid too much, and that as a result of this, insurance premiums were real high and people weren't able to get insurance. Now, this was generated by the defense bar in the insurance industry. Now, the studies that have been done already have been referenced here. There aren't a large number of large jury verdicts in Alaska. There aren't a number of large settlements in Alaska. And the study showed that attorneys weren't getting paid huge amounts of money. There's no point in doing this study all over again because the results aren't going to be any different. You're going to get lower verdicts. You're going to get lower settlements. The attorneys made much more in the older days than they do now. The only suggestion I would have is that the language of the bill should be amended, section 0968130, section 1, says that judicial counsel shall periodically collect and evaluate information. I think that the word shall, being mandatory, should be changed to may, being discretionary.
The judicial Ken, let me interrupt just a little bit. I think you have the wrong version in front of you. You're looking at W. We have version H in front of us. And version H has taken that whole section out. The 0968.130 is totally removed, and so the language on H is just simply that that's repealed.
Oh, the whole statute's repealed? Okay, I'd support that. I printed this out from the Internet this morning, so from your legislative page. So, all right, yeah.
Let the record reflect that we're ahead of you this time.
You're ahead of me.
Yeah.
And you're more in accord with the position that I would adopt. Well, things should be repealed because it costs money for the clients. By the way, I'm in the same position as Mr. Jamieson, whether it's plaintiff or defense. I fully comply with the requirements because I know about them, and it's a matter of law that we have to obey it. I do not charge the clients for doing it. I take the time and do it as it's part of my office overhead. I think it takes, depending on the case, it takes a half hour to an hour to complete the form and the calculations that are required for each case. It's just, I know other attorneys will charge their clients, but it's, we're not generating any useful information, and the whole thing should be scrapped. It's it wastes money for the state, it wastes money for the private bar, it wastes money for the private practitioners. Anybody have any questions? I'll be happy to answer them.
We have one from Representative Clayton.
Ken, thanks for testifying today. In your, I think the original bill that you were referencing did what one might call as a half step. Instead of requiring it, it would have allowed the council to make requests to collect information. And I think the committee substitute just does away with the whole authority to collect information at all. And it sounds like, would it be fair to say that the original bill was kind of a half step and this is a whole step and you're more supportive of the whole step?
I'm much more supportive of the whole step. Oh, and by the way, I don't think that the Alaska Bar Association would be very happy for being the enforcement mechanism if this thing were kept. I mean, they can't deal with thousands of disciplinary complaints because people don't file their required reports. They don't know about it. It doesn't furnish any information. Get rid of it.
Thank you for your testimony, Ken. And I didn't mean to suggest that they would be overjoyed with that requirement. But anyway, we're going to go to Sarah. Sarah Batten.
Thank you. Thank you. Can you hear me?
We got you loud and clear now. Please identify yourself for the record. Give us your testimony.
Thank you. Through the chair, my name is Sarah Batten. I'm an attorney with Grill Eggers, LLC. I have been practicing in Alaska for only 7 years, so I wasn't around when the tort reform was happening, and I'm sure that at the time there was a good reason and a desire to have that information. I do not understand how there is any need or desire for that information today, and I would agree with Mr. Jameson and Mr. Jacobus and everything that they said, and I wholeheartedly support the repeal of this statute. I do not practice other than maybe once or twice in any tort cases. I practice in contract law, and so I would agree with Mr. Jameson in that I, too, am skewing your data because I fill out the form every time that a case settles, which is often. And it is based on contract principles where generally I'm suing over a lien foreclosure or payment of money. People pay the money that's owed and the case is dismissed. So it's not reflective of any super settlement or I don't think it would be any information useful to the judicial council or the legislature. And it takes a lot of time when you're talking about multiple lawsuits. I file many lawsuits, and generally they are dismissed quite quickly. When you're talking about collecting money or foreclosing someone's home, generally people take that quite seriously and want to resolve those matters quickly. Generally, as well, in the contract that I deal with, those costs are transferred back to that borrower or owner. And I, of course, want to keep those costs down, but it is part of my time, and I do charge that to my client, who then passes that cost through to the owner. And so I would love to see this statute repealed. It is archaic, in my opinion, and it costs time and money that is unnecessary. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Sarah. I don't see any signals from the committee on questions, but we really appreciate you taking time to call in. Is there anybody else online? I don't have any more. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify in HB 83? We're going to go ahead and close public testimony, and then I'm going to take an at ease here and give the gavel back.
Okay, we're back on the record again, and next up is HB 15, and the sponsor of that is Representative Wilson. And Representative Wilson, looks like you're already up here even before I asked you to. That's okay. Beat me to the punch. And if you could identify yourself for the record and then introduce your aide to us and present the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, very much. For the record, my name is Representative Tammy Wilson. I represent North Pole District 3. With me is my handy aide, Teresa Volstad, who makes sure that I don't make mistakes on the computer. This started out to be a very simple bill with just one little idea that just kind of keeps growing. So I am not looking, if you haven't said, for this bill to move today is not ready for that. But we have learned a lot, and I think when we get done, this will be one of the answers to some of our issues we have with the budget.
Is there any such thing as a simple bill in this body, Ms. Representative Wilson?
I truly thought there was, Madam Chair, but I have been corrected since then. If it would work for you, Madam Chair, if you could, though, adopt the work draft so that our presentation matches our bill, that would be very nice. And I'm talking about 29-LS0102/N.
Could I have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I will move LS0102N before committee for consideration. That's House Bill 15.
Thank you. That's going to be our working draft.
Perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair. The state of Alaska faces rising incarceration costs, growing correctional populations, and declining financial resources. To face this challenge, Alaska must seek out alternatives which maximize the state financial resources while providing rehabilitation services for incarcerated individuals. It is the purpose of HB 15 to grant credit against a sentence of imprisonment and award good time for deduction while on electronic monitoring. It is the mission of the Alaska Department of Corrections to provide secure confinement, reformative programs, and provide a process of supervised community reintegration to enhance the safety of our communities. Under current statutes, a convicted prisoner is entitled to a deduction of one-third of the term of imprisonment under good time deductions if the prisoner follows the rules of the correctional facility in which the prisoner is confined. However, if a prisoner spends any time in a treatment program or while under electronic monitoring, they are ineligible. The penalization for seeking treatment, maintaining employment, or starting the process of reintegration into the community stands in stark contrast to the goals outlined by DOC. A diverse range of programs are available to prisoners to facilitate an individual's reintegration. Electronic monitoring is a tool utilized by DOC that provides cost-effective supervision of offenders while reducing recidivism. The electronic monitoring program allows qualified incarcerated individuals to serve time at home while adhering to the program conditions. Qualified individuals can gain access to community-based treatment, maintain employment, access diverse medical treatment, perform community service work, and begin the process of reintegration. The ability to grant credit against a sentence of imprisonment for time spent under supervision of electronic monitoring or within a treatment program can potentially save the state of Alaska over $11 million a year. The state of Alaska has an opportunity to substantially save money while increasing Alaskans' access to community-based treatments, ability to maintain employment, and reduce recidivism. HB 15 promotes the mission of DOC by encouraging the use of reformative programs while fostering community-based integrations. So the purpose of the electronic program, monitoring program, and I want to make sure, Madam Chair, that you that is clear that we are not changing those who are eligible. If you have to be eligible based on DOC recommendations and also by the courts determining what kind of monitoring you may have to be. So we are not changing those requirements. So if you commit certain crimes, you're ineligible now and you will be ineligible at this point as well. So here are just the seven requirements right now by DOC that will stay in effect even with this bill. And I know you all know how to read, so I'm not going to read them to you. And these are the areas currently for electronic monitoring. We would hope that as this program can grow and more can be eligible for that, there would be besides Fairbanks, Kenai, Ketchikan, Sitka, Mat-Su, Girdwood, and the Anchorage area. Electronic monitoring, I've learned a lot about it that I didn't know before. They have them now, what's called a 24/7 program, if you haven't heard, but literally, if you take a drink of alcohol, the monitor will know that. So those who have an alcohol issue versus the way that we did it in the past where you had a monitor and every so often you would randomly be chosen to have to be able to go for a test, which if you have a job could cause some problems where you might have to leave work to have this done. This is on there 24/7. They are able to download it at the end of the day or the end of the week at approximately $105 for 7 days to be on this monitor versus over $150 a day in it. They just become amazing what they can do at this point. So monitors have come a very long way. And this is just a picture of one of them. There are more than this. Department of Corrections has their program as well as there's also private companies that do it. So this we did some simple math. We come from finance, so we want to kind of show you how we came up with our savings. So in FY 2014, a total of 2,034 individuals participated in the Department of Corrections Electronic Monitoring Program. Participants served a total of 134,585 days, which averaged about 66 days per year. If good time deductions were provided in 2014 participants, it would have reduced the participant days by 44,862. The other interesting fact I found out is once you get the third for good time, you don't just get off. You then go into parole. And what really good time was meant to, it wasn't just about behaving or showing behavior change when you were being incarcerated, but it was actually a step down. So once you were in jail, you would go on parole to help you find perhaps a job, a place to live. I don't think that it's actually being done, Madam Chair, at this point because we have so many prisoners per parole officer. I'm not even sure that's being met at this point. But what this would do is put you in your own setting. You're already having to abide by the rules, and if you don't abide by the rules, you go back and you serve it within jail. So you're getting used to that in your own setting. You're keeping your job, or you're getting treatment, which we've all heard that being an issue while you're incarcerated, that we don't have enough treatment programs within our system. And at that point, the difference is also who's paying for that treatment. And don't we really want to encourage those who currently, you know, have these kind of issues to do treatment and not penalize them? I think so. So here's my favorite chart. So this is a potential cost savings per individual. And again, we're trying to incentivize a program that already exists. And one of those we're hoping is that if I sit in jail, even on pretrial, I get credit just for sitting there. I go and I say, I'm going to go get treatment while I'm waiting to go to trial. I don't. That just to me seems very backwards to be able to do that. So this is just a little bit more of the savings that we base it on. If 10% more took advantage of that, we could be looking at a $13 million savings to the department, 25% up to $15 million. And again, that's based on the same rules that we currently have. So this is the other great slide is one of the things that we've heard about more than anything else is what do we do so that we don't have a turnkey? Coming out one door, coming back in the other door. Well, this program, the reduction of 31% reduction for recidivism if they are on the monitoring program. And again, I think the reason is because you're putting them back in their own community, you know, versus taking them completely out of it, not used to telling people, no, I'm not going to do that anyway anymore, not the kind of treatment that they need to be able to pick to be able to do that. And again, this is some more recidivism rights based on if they're doing electronic monitoring. As you see, the numbers are, we can only hope that they would be this high if we were able to go here. And electronic monitoring devices, the BiTab, proven effective in Alaska. This is the one that many use that are private vendors as well as the Department of Corrections. And I think they also have some other, I think I jumped the slide, didn't I? 18% recidivism rate for offenders who served their entire sentence on the EM programs and were released time served. So, what do we learn here? The state can save a lot of money. If program was utilized by individuals already enrolled in electronic monitoring during FY 2014, the state would save $12 million. Now, the sad part is if you're on electronic monitoring right now, this bill doesn't do you any good. But it's for those potential savings. Electronic monitor has proven to be effective in Alaska. We have been using it, just not to what I believe that we could be doing it with hopefully these incentives that go with it. So, Madam Chair, what are the changes in the ones that you adopted? It was never our intent that it would be just private residents without having, it's all based on electronic monitoring. You know, also the other part we added is that, of course, if you commit another crime when you're on electronic monitoring, you do not get time served or good time because you haven't been very good. So why is this bill not ready to be passed today, Madam Chair, you may be asking yourself. Because as I have asked more questions, I have found other sections of the statute on this. So this is what I would like to work with the committee, and also we have been working with the court system, law, and DOC. So there's another part in an amendment we had written up that is not to you that asked the question, should we just offer it to those going into a treatment program, actually a residential treatment program, or the 24/7 program that we're hearing would not be eligible under the current way that this bill is written because it's not a residential treatment. However, you're being monitored 24/7, you're holding a job down, you're doing those things that we really want you to be able to do outside of a treatment program. If you have a job and that's pre-sentence and you want to be able to keep your job, right now that is not also covered for pretrial. And I'll give you, I'm getting some very interesting calls. So I had a gentleman give me a call, and he has been on electronic monitoring for the last 5 months. He was charged with a DUI. He has been clean for 5 months. He has not violated in any fashion, and he will get no credit for that 5 months. If he had been sitting in jail, he would have gotten credit for all 5 months. That to me just seems so backwards. Also, hopefully, you know, if he continues to do this, his concern was, and this is another, you know, research that we want to be able to do, once he gets sentenced, because we understand he is, so it's not because we're saying he's guilty, is can he stay on the same monitor he already is versus one of these other monitors where he'll have to go in and check in with somebody randomly. Well, if you have a job and all of a sudden at 1 o'clock you get called and you have to go in and take that, you may have an employer who's not very happy. Where he is right now, he is being monitored 24/7. I don't know how much more you can do than that. So we have wonderful tools, Madam Chair, that I just don't think we're utilizing to the way we have. I'm excited to learn about this subject, which probably seems a little strange, but I look forward to seeing whether or not this is as far as we want to go at this point and really incentivize the treatment program portion of it and those that have already been convicted in jail right now. And that brings my last point is also our bill, and again through an email. I love people who read my bill. You know, this would not, currently written, if you're in prison and you want to take advantage of electronic monitoring, not currently on it, you would not be eligible underneath this bill. And that kind of wouldn't give us a money savings that we were really looking for, because it is proven the longer one stays in jail without getting the right kind of treatment or being able to get back into society, having that step down, the more likely you are to stay within our system. And I think everyone here can agree that's the biggest thing that we're trying to do, is get Alaskans, you know, out, being able to be in society, have a family, and do everything that you can being Alaskans. With that, Madam Chair, I really appreciate this opportunity, and your staff has been great as we have had ever-changing bills coming through our office. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Wilson, Ms. Wolfstadt. And I want to thank you for realizing, without us telling you, that this bill isn't ready to leave committee. So thank you very much, and continue working on it. Does anybody have any questions? Representative Keller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you run across what the average amount of time is being spent between arrest and sentencing? The pretrial time, I heard some numbers, and I can't remember what they are, except that they were big. And our Constitution guarantees a speedy trial, and if we could, in the process of the hearing on this bill, if we get some information on that, I would appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keller, you're absolutely right. For pretrial, like the gentleman I just expressed, for 5 months he's been waiting to be heard. And if you're not, I don't know whether you're aware, because I wasn't to start with, that if you're sitting in jail waiting for it, you can actually, and then you're found innocent,
you've got time banked, you know, because you served and you didn't have to serve. So it's more timekeeping that you have to do, but it's because we, you know, the system sometimes doesn't work as fast as we thought it could.
Well, we,
actually, I was, you can follow up, and then I want to follow up with with that last statement.
I was pretty shocked too, Madam Chair.
Well, if you get the information back to us, the amount of time and the number of people we're talking about in the state that are in this position, and then I was thinking of the banked time, maybe we could get, no, I won't suggest who could serve. No, I'll stop there. Another question I have is I would like you, you know, after at some point, explain why you backed away from the house arrest. As I understand it, the conditions of bail sometimes include released with somebody as a custodian, and they spend time, you know, basically locked at a house arrest. And why did you back off from that at some point, if you would? But she had a follow-up. You don't have to go there.
Well, let me answer it, if I may, Madam Chair. Ma'am, okay. That was never our intent, Representative Keller. That was kind of an accident. We really wanted the electronic monitoring the whole time. We just took a part of the statute that looked like they took just that part out. There also was a court case that said that if you're just in your residence, just kind of being yourself and not being able to go where you want, because a lot of times that third party, if they go to the grocery store, you go to the grocery store. We've heard ones where they've gone to work, or, you know, whatever it takes. It's not the same type of monitoring as these electronic monitors, especially since most of those that we have in jail right now are there because of drugs and alcohol. And that is really what we're monitoring more than that. Courts have also been concerned sometimes that maybe the third party is really not monitoring the person as well as they should. And this one, you don't have to worry about whether or not you're in a different part of the house.
Yeah, you can follow up.
I'm sorry.
She's not going to.
But it is on that one. It just seems like, you know, might be worth consideration. I'm not, you know, it's your bill and you can decide. But I know that my limited experience, there are some people that take being released in custody very serious, and it changes the life of the person that takes it serious and is in a position of house arrest. And I'm just suggesting that maybe the appropriate response would be for us to may do something to ensure that the terms of the bail are met, rather than just ignoring that arena and letting it get weaker. But I just for what it's worth, I like the idea of including it if we can, and I would like to hear reasons why not, you know. So,
really, true, Representative Keller, I have some really bright people behind me who can probably answer that question better than I, since I'm not an attorney.
Representative Wilson, you mentioned something about banked time. Does that mean that if you're acquitted and you've got time that you've served, that you can use it to the next time you get arrested?
It is my understanding that it's true. I was pretty amazed myself, Madam Chair. Because, and the explanation, because I don't want to just leave people hanging there, is that, you know, you weren't found guilty of it. So, you know, literally you served time for something that now you've been acquitted to do, and later on you can use it.
Just for curiosity's sake, I'd like to ask Mr. Savodny to come up here if he could and confirm that is correct, or he could just nod his head if he wants to. And you're going to be testifying on this bill?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Clayman.
Just not a question, but a comment, that the notion that you can, and I wasn't aware that if you spend 90 days in jail on the 2010 charge, that then you've banked 90 days for your conviction in 2016 on a new charge brings frequent flyer to a whole new level. and I suspect Mr. Svermani may comment on it as well, but one of the questions Representative Keller was asking about home arrest in the pretrial context, it's very common that a pretrial release is not nearly as restrictive as a house arrest post-sentencing, and it's fairly common if somebody is trying to negotiate to get jail credit before they get sentenced, so they're doing it as part of their pretrial release. They'll actually negotiate that with the prosecution and make sure they're getting going in a place and having it set up in a way that they will get credit and they're not going to take that risk. And that's actually part of the pretrial negotiations. And I think the last part that's in terms of speedy trial, I'm sure the gentleman that's been contacting Mrs. Wilson on advice of counsel waived his speedy trial more than once as he tried to work it out. It really never happens that somebody who wants to get their trial on the speedy trial right, the court gets them in there in time every time.
More of a case of delay.
Happy to take
them. Any more questions for Representative Wilson? Well, hearing none and seeing none, I will open this now up to public testimony. And it looks like we have Carrie Belden from the Department of Corrections online to answer questions, and Doug Gardner from Legislative Legal to answer questions. And then we also have off-net. The first person is Billy Hauser. Would you please identify yourself for the record and state your name and your affiliation, and then you can proceed.
My name is Billy Hauser. I'm a probation supervisor. I'm the program manager for Department of Corrections electronic monitoring, and I would like to thank the chair and members for this opportunity to speak. I'm not clear at this point exactly what changes have been made. The last draft I looked at is roughly 24 hours old. However, I think that the key issue here, from what I heard through testimony earlier, was really, in essence, the good time issue, which is actually part of the Section 4 of the draft that I was looking at earlier. And that one actually deals with good behavior while a prisoner is confined at a correctional facility. And that it is, of course, somewhat problematic for the electronic monitoring programs. But the draft that I'd looked at previously actually would have been just fine and would have resolved a lot of those issues if the last portion, which talked about ordered by the court and the defendant has not committed a crime while in the residential treatment program or under electronic monitoring, if that portion of the last sentence was removed, that amendment actually could achieve some of the goals of this legislation, which from what I understand is both rehabilitation and hopefully reducing the individuals that we actually have in custody. However, the first three sections of the draft that I looked at, which talked about sentencing and pretrial credit, there are a lot of problems involved with that one.
Mr. Hauser, which draft, I just want to make sure that we know which draft you may be looking at.
The draft that I'm looking at, Section 1, adds an amendment to AS 12.55.025.
Does it have on the draft a number, though, and a date, like 29-LSO-102 and then slash, and is there something like that after it that you're looking at?
Actually, I don't believe it does. If I can find it here.
Mr. Hauser, the sponsors just informed me that it sounds like you may not be looking at the right draft. And there has been a new CS that we're dealing with, LSO-102/E, I believe.
N, right?
N, excuse me.
Yeah. Is that one actually on the...
Look in the upper right-hand corner.
Madam Chair, just to probably help Representative Wilson, what he's looking at, he is looking at the one that we got last night, this one we didn't get to this morning, the section that he says is problematic. He is absolutely correct, and that's why it is not part of the bill. The original bill, that might just be a little bit more helpful for anybody who's going to testify. From the original bill, the only two things that were done to it is we took out "in a private residence" out of the bill at this point, and then we added the sentence, "if the defendant has not committed a crime while under electronic monitoring." And then on Section 2, again, we put in "residential," so it's a residential treatment program, and then also at the end of it said, "if the defendant has not committed a crime while under electronic monitoring." So the section he was wanting to testify on that has a problem, he's absolutely right, and that's why it's not in the current one.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Mr. Hauser, did you hear that?
Yes, ma'am. I understand that the only thing that everything was removed except for the prior Section 4, which actually addresses AS 332010C. Is that correct?
Representative Wilson.
Okay, so Section 1, this might be the easiest way to do it, is AS 12.55.027D, which was in the original bill. So are you with me?
Yes.
Okay, so we took out "in a private residence." Okay, so now it has "for time spent under electronic monitoring." And then we added "if the defendant has not committed a crime while under electronic monitoring."
Okay.
Okay, and then AS 33.20.010C was amended, and what we did on that is that it should read now, "a prisoner shall be awarded a good time deduction under A of this section for any period spent in a residential treatment program or while under electronic monitoring if the defendant has not committed a crime while under electronic monitoring."
Thank you, Representative Wilson. I think I may have it straightened out now in my head.
Well, my apologies. We did send the one we got last night. We were trying to get as clear as we were, and we dropped that because we want to work with you on that section that you're speaking about. So thank you.
Yes, ma'am. From an electronic monitoring standpoint and from a restorative justice philosophy standpoint, looking at these, allowing the court to give sentence credit towards somebody in a pretrial status is very, very problematic. Currently, and some of the issues that I frequently see are, one, the bail companies are non-regulated. They are actually in a for-profit position, where if you don't have the money to pay for the bail and electronic monitoring, then you're not going to receive those services. They don't do it for free. The program rules are all over the map. In essence, I heard earlier testimony that frequently defendants seek continuance after continuance and waive the right to a speedy trial. Just recently, within the last week, I reviewed an electronic monitoring application where an individual had already served three and a half years out to a private bail company on electronic monitoring. And he would be taking a plea agreement here shortly where he would serve a 3-year flat time sentence. This individual, this will be his third felony conviction. So he would have been presumptive under sentencing guidelines. In essence, this individual, if the court were to allow him to receive credit for the time he was out on bail, he would not have served a single day in jail for a conviction that required 3 years. There's so much disparate treatment involved with that it's very problematic. And another major issue with this is the judges are not familiar enough with correctional interstate compact rules and regulations for actual correctional facilities and probation and parole, where they conceivably start giving credit for individuals who are living out of state, who go to a private bail company to, quote, serve their sentence, and then they get the jail credit for it, where in fact this individual should have been processed through the Interstate Compact for corrections. And if that process isn't met or regulated, then the state is subject to the civil penalties, which is really a bad idea. In essence, I think the goal of this whole thing is the last portion, which actually dealt with AS 332010C, and it looks like I actually do have the copy of that that is in the current proposal. And that would actually would serve the goal of help reducing the individuals incarcerated, because quite realistically, Department of Corrections right now has the ability to place pretrial prisoners on electronic monitoring house arrest. It's a designation process. And the only thing that really keeps us from doing that currently is the good time credit statute. Because if we place them on pretrial, then they don't get the good time. But if we designate them to pretrial, they would. So I actually think the goal could be achieved just by changing or amending 332010C. And the draft that I just looked at, where it was added back in that the residential treatment program was added, and just take off that last portion that says ordered by the court and the defendant has not committed a crime in the residential treatment program under electronic monitoring. Striking that, I mean, this thing would work perfect and would increase the number of individuals that the department could place on electronic monitoring, and would give us the ability to manage this group and program them to meet the rehabilitative needs. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hauser. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Hauser? Well, thank you. Thank you again for your testimony. And the next person that I'd like to call is Douglas Moody. Mr. Moody, are you online?
Madam Chair, I am.
All right. Please identify yourself for the record, and then you can proceed.
My name is Douglas Moody. I'm with the Public Defender Agency. Madam Chair and committee members, I called in to support the proposal, Representative Wilson's proposal. I think it's a good idea. For a lot of offenders, electronic monitoring is sufficient both to protect the public and to provide the necessary structure to reintegrate them, to get them back in. I mean, the whole idea with a lot of the offenders we have in jail is that we're mad at them about their behavior, not so much afraid of them, and we want them to change their behavior. And whatever we can do to change the behavior and get them plugged back in so that they're productive members of society is great. And I think this bill works and will do that. I have a quick follow-up to Mr. Hauser. Anything that helps the Department of Corrections expand its electronic monitoring program, either post-trial and pre-trial, we would support, because that would benefit the public defender's particular client base, in that they have sliding scales for their electronic monitoring so that indigent defendants can participate. Whereas Mr. Hauser's correct, I mean, if it's totally left to the free market, a lot of our public defender clients can't get out because they can't pay the fees. The other thing I would like to address is on the banking. the question about banking time. And the way it works is any time that you only, the time that you spend in jail can only be credited to a case that you're in jail upon. So if you end up like doing 6 months for on one case and then you get acquitted, that time is dead time. It doesn't ever count again. Where the banking situation arises when you have probation hearings, where a guy might sit in jail waiting for a probation revocation hearing for like 60 days, finally appears in front of the judge revokes 30 days, and so that he's done 60, so then he has 30 days in the bank for the next violation, but on that case only. And then I'm available for any questions.
Thank you much, Mr. Moody. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Moody? All right. Well, hearing none, thank you for being available, and thank you for testifying. So there doesn't appear to be anybody else off net. Is there anybody in the audience, Mr. Sabadney, to begin with?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name's Rick Sabadney, and I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. I guess I'd like to start by thanking the sponsor and her staff for dealing with concerns that the Department of Law had. For example, getting credit for going home tonight and sleeping in my own bed, especially if I can bank it for the next crime, because I got a lot of years banked up. I'm going to try to come at this from a different point, and maybe it'll make things a little bit more understandable, and not focus so much on electronic monitoring or whether I get credit for jail time and for staying in my private residence or somebody else's private residence. So let me start by two concepts. They sound a lot alike, but they aren't the same thing at all. There's credit for time served. If you, in pretrial, if you, before you've been sentenced, you can get credit for time that has been in jail, or credit for time you've been in treatment programs, okay? And what this bill suggests is, what's added to that is you get credit for time that you're on electronic monitoring. The other concept, and I almost dread to bring it up here because it starts to get confusing right away, is good time credit. That is credit that you've been sentenced to a term in jail, and to control you in jail, you get a reduction of 1 day for every 3 days you serve. Okay? So let me first just address the credit for time served pretrial. The way today you get credit for time in custody pretrial is if you really are in custody. If you're in jail, if the judge said bail's $100,000 and you can't post $100,000, or if the judge says bail's $10 and you can't post $10, you may stay in jail unless there are other conditions that the court would release you on. For every day that you are in jail, you get credit for that time in jail. And I don't think anybody's disputing that people should get credit for time in jail when they actually are in jail. In 1980, the Alaska Supreme Court said, if a court orders you to do something that's the functional equivalent of jail, that it's like jail in many respects, and pretrial, that you should get credit for that too. And you may have heard over the years being in the legislature people talking about Locke, Nygren, two cases that set out that proposition, that if a court orders you pretrial, kind of as a condition of bail, to a treatment program, that you should get credit just like you were sitting in jail. So that's what we're talking about. But that's what the courts said. There were There were examples of courts granting credit because they ordered something that many people, including members of the legislature, were not the smartest thing for the court to do. For example, a treatment program that a lawyer, I hate to mention that profession, ran outside of Anchorage for alcohol treatment in a bar at a place called Sergeant Preston's. The courts granted credit for that. For showing up at Health and Social Services or an entity designated by Health and Social Services to take medication that wasn't related to alcohol or the crime or something like that. It was a court order. Some judges thought that was the functional equivalent, and that's kind of the key words here, equivalent of jail, and we're giving people credit for that.
May I
have
a question?
Go ahead, Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Sabatini, are you talking now about credit for good time or time served?
Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Representative Grunberg, conditions of bail that are set by the court prior to trial, prior to conviction, not good time. That's what I'm saying. We have to keep these things separated. I'm just talking about credit for time actually served.
Thank you.
Okay?
Yeah.
They're getting, and so in 2007, the legislature said, wait a minute. You know, there's got to be some standards here. And I will tell you, the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court were pretty good about saying to judges, it doesn't count when you went out fishing. That was one of the cases. Person said, the judge said, I'm releasing you, go fishing with your father, and then it comes in and says, I want credit for jail. That was the same as being in jail. Actually, I got a better example. Trial court said yes, the Court of Appeals said no. The guy who got released to the custody of his mother had to go home and stay with his mother. He came into court and said, that's like jail. And the court gave him credit, and the Court of Appeals overturned that. And in 2007, the legislature said, wait a minute, let's put some standards in the law. And that's where 1255.027, the first section, the credit for time served, comes in here. And this body said, look, if you really go into a treatment program and you know it's got restrictions on it that are what the Supreme Court and Court of Appeals said are the functional equivalent of jail, you get a day credit for every day you've been in that program. You don't even need to complete the program, but just for every day you've been in it, you get credit for that. So that's where 1225.027 comes in. And now the question is, I understand that the sponsor is dropped off, staying at a private residence should count if the court orders that. But maintains the electronic monitoring. I'm not arguing that electronic monitoring is not a good thing, that it's not a helpful tool, but I would suggest to you it is not the functional equivalent of jail. I could be wearing an ankle bracelet right now. Some people may, I may feel like I'm a little bit in jail here, but it would count under this bill. I mean, during the legislative session, I live by the federal building. I walk to work, stay at my office, walk back. If the court were to order that and me wear an ankle bracelet, that would count as time in jail. So that's what Section 1 does. It doesn't set, and Mr. Hauser brought this to your attention, it doesn't, it's just like being back to the old days before you set standards for treatment programs, because what does it mean? Does it mean that if I wear the ankle bracelet just in that walk between my house and my work that I get credit? Or do I just get credit for the 15 minutes that takes? Do I get 2 days credit because I wore it in the morning and I wore it back at night? So there are no standards imposed like the legislature found necessary to do for the treatment programs. There had to be a legitimate treatment program. The program had to come back to court and say, yes, he was in our program this amount of time, and it was 21 days, and there would be reporting to the police if he left the program. So, no, it's obvious you can do what you will about it, but the core principle of Section, I think it's under 2 under the draft that you're now looking at, but anyhow, 1255.027, is that you get a day, if you serve time in jail, or you serve kind of, if you're outside of jail, and you do the functional equivalent of jail time, that you should get credit. And that's the question that you really need to answer, is wearing an electronic bracelet the functional equivalent of incarceration. Now, I understand that it can be a legal fiction to reduce jail population, but wouldn't it be better generally to just say we're going to reduce jail population by giving for whatever reason, other than saying, it was the functional equivalent of being in jail to wear an ankle bracelet. Let me turn to the other part of the bill, and that's the part that Mr. Hauser talked about.
If you would, Rick, make that last point again, I would really appreciate it. I drifted or something, but you compared two things. Wouldn't it be better to...
Oh, through the chair, Representative Keller, I'm going to be losing a lot of prosecutors, right? There's not money to pay for them. I rather, have people do less time in jail and not have people who have provided good service, lose their jobs. So I'm not opposed in general to reducing the amount of time that some people go to jail, but why don't we just call it that? Let's commute everybody by one third of their time instead of creating a legal fiction. So that's what I was trying to say.
That brings up thoughts. I'd love to have a discussion, but I know the time. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. So I'm going to pass on that for now, but I want to come back to that at some point. Thanks.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is slightly confusing because of the way Section 1, and I'm only looking at Section 1, because of the way Section 1 is currently drafted and the way Section 1 is proposed to be drafted. It's currently drafted in the negative, may not grant credit. And now it's going to be drafted in the exact opposite way, shall grant credit. And rather than trying to get my head around a concept that on a late Friday afternoon is kind of confusing, what would you suggest Section 1 say?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I shouldn't even try to answer that. I think, well, I'm not trying to dodge the issue here. I think that there's no need to change anything in 1255.027. And the reason it says it shall not grant credit is for all those examples that I assumed you agreed with me because you laughed. Courts were granting people credit for time for staying with their mother. That's why in 2007 you said they shall not grant credit for that.
Okay, may I continue, please?
I'd like to.
I don't remember those cases. I sat here at that time, but I can't begin to fathom what went on. And I know nobody else here at this table was here at that time either. So let's not go back at that point. My question to you, and let's be very direct here. The current language is that the court may not grant credit under any circumstance against a sentence of imprisonment for time spent in a private residence. Can you think of any circumstance where they should be able to do that?
Through the chair, I certainly can. I mean, if somebody is, and I've used the words that got us here, in the functional equivalent of jail, then yes. If, using me again as the example, I'm charged with DUI and the court says, I'm not going to impose bail. I'm going to release you on your own recognizance, or I'm going to post, you got to post $100, whatever it is. But I also order that you live, at your residence or a room in the Baranoff or wherever. You don't leave that room. I would say that's a functional equivalent of incarceration.
So then, if I may.
Go ahead.
And I'm trying to parse this out. So it's simple, direct, and we can all understand what the current situation is, and I'm kind of looking at the sponsor there, too.
She's not at the desk.
I understand. It sounds to me, Mr. Svobodny, and I wanted to wait so you would catch this, too. Yeah. It sounds to me like you're saying that you would support allowing credit for time in a private residence if it's the functional equivalent of incarceration or something to that effect. Through the chair, right?
Through the chair, yes.
And I don't know, let me continue on. This is just a question at this point. Secondly, can you see any circumstance under which credit should be granted for electronic monitoring?
Through the chair, Representative Gruberg, it is hard for me to think of a circumstance where if all that the court is requiring is that I wear an ankle bracelet, I can't conceive that as anybody thinking that's the same thing as being in jail. I mean, no one would say, I'm going to flip a coin, and I don't really care which way it goes. I'm going to sit in jail, or I'm going to wear an ankle monitor. I don't believe that somebody would just say, okay, I'm going to do that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Clayman.
Mr. Svobodny, you kind of prefaced your comments, if I understood correctly, by saying that up until 2007, when AS 1225.027 was passed, that the courts did a pretty good job of developing a common law of what constituted the functional equivalent of jail for purposes of what we know as a legal matter is an Igrin credit. Go ahead and respond, and then I'll follow
through
up.
Through the chair, yes, if you mean by the appellate courts. Yes.
Yes, that's what I mean. The established case law where you can look up, read them in the books and see what, and sometimes they corrected the trial courts, as you note about, I think, the fisherman and the mother were two examples that come to mind. And I'm certainly familiar that, because my staff found one of the cases and had me read it this morning, that since 2007, when AS 1225027 was passed, that there's been considerable additional litigation about Nigrin credit and the old common law of Nigrin credit versus the statutory law, which turned out to not perfectly match Nigrin credit. And so the philosophical question, because I know this, but we're not deciding and the bill's going to come up again, the philosophical question I have for you is, are we really better off trying to define this as a legislature by statute, or might we be better off saying, hey, wait a second, the courts are actually doing a pretty good job developing this as common law and adapting to modern technology as it comes up. Would we be better off kind of getting out of the business of defining this and let the courts continue to deal with it rather than trying to write this as statutes? Because I'm hearing from different people saying the judges are applying the statutes differently. It seems to have gotten harder in recent years to get Nigrin credit than it used to be before the legislature got involved in this whole process. It is very complicated, I completely agree. So that's the philosophical question, and I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Through the chair, if I can follow it. The question is, are we better off letting the courts deal with it? It depends on what you would do. if we were going to give the people credit for staying in their own homes or wearing an ankle bracelet, I know what the courts have said about that. For the part we're talking about so far, which is, you know, credit for time served. And sure, I have no problems in letting I don't have a problem with the appellate court decisions, whether it starts with Nigrin, you get credit for the functional equivalent of incarceration, or if it goes to, as you said, you're absolutely right, there is a few, the existing statute is a little bit more restrictive, I think, than where the courts were at the time you passed it, but not. I can't remember the nuances, but it's a kind of a nuance issue as opposed to a real big public policy issue. I think that the courts differed with the legislature on, but actually they said they're going to follow up the legislature.
Mr. Spondi, is it possible that we find ourselves in the legislative predicament that we're in right now with this statute, because there were a few off-the-wall cases by the superior courts that maybe the Department of Law and the legislature reacted to, and that perhaps we might want to consider going back to the system, especially now that the common law perhaps has been more developed, in that the trial courts have a little bit more discretion as to determine what the functional equivalent of jail is, now with the guidance of the appellate courts telling them what the functional equivalent of jail is?
Madam Chair, I have two answers to that. One is I think, yes, we might be better off. So let me start from that point of view. I think the reason that we ended up kind of with what I would call less than appropriate decisions by the trial courts, and this is mostly it's district court as well as superior court, is that it's really hard to predict without standards whether something's gonna work or not, and then you end up not bothering to litigate the issue of, well, was this really, was the guy who got arrested at the movie theater on a date, was he really in jail or not? Which is another Juneau case, you know, and the judge said no, he wasn't in jail, but he was staying at Gaston O'Manor at night, but he was at work at the day, and was noisy at the movie theater, so he got caught there with his girlfriend, not on a date. Dinner and a date wasn't the same as being in jail. So, but we had to litigate that. So there's two answers. Yes, I think is a, if we put the resources into fighting about it, both from the defense point of view and the state's point of view, we're just fine with the appellate court decisions.
So would it be possible, do you think, rather than having a statute that, like it is right now, saying the courts may not grant, that perhaps we'd be in the best situation that we could if we maybe had a statute which went over a number of guidelines that the court should be considering when they make that decision? I just throw that out to you for consideration.
Madam Chair, that's what's in the sections before D. That's A, B, C. You've done that in 2007 with kind of the major place that people were getting credit, and that's treatment programs. So, yes.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Grunberg.
I like the way we're generally conceptually going here. The members should have subsection C in front of them here. And what we're really, it sounds like, talking about is, in place of the kind of thing in Section 1 of the bill, coming up with something that is tailored to this situation in Section 1, but drafted somewhat like subsection C. That, to me, uses the concept of functional equivalent, or whatever you choose to call it, and tries to provide some guidelines. And I was trying to find some type of common ground here that might make some sense, and that seems to me to have some benefit.
Thank you. So are there any more questions that anybody has for Mr. Asvadi? Are you finished with your presentation?
Madam Chairman, I would like to get to the other half.
Oh, go right ahead.
The other section, Section 3, that's the credit for good time, okay? And it's in that an entirely different concept. I mean, that is, as the sponsor said, a tool as to how corrections cause people to behave. They give you, by the day you come in, a third off of your sentence, and then as you mess up, they potentially take that time away. And what's being said here is after you're out on probation or parole, if you are out on probation and parole, so you've served your time, you got a third off, you served your time, and now you are on probation or parole and you're using electronic monitoring, you get a day that should count as a day off for, you should get credit for good time if that turns out, if you turn out to need it because your probation is being revoked or your parole is being revoked. And so if you're not in custody, it seems to me that it is even a bigger legal fiction to say, oh, we're going to give you a day off for each 3 days you serve on this so we can monitor your, so you will behave. I mean, the idea of being out on probation and parole is you should behave. I want to make one final comment about this, and I'm not saying this in a derogatory way about electronic monitoring. Remember, it is a device to help for public protection, and it has the ancillary effect of hopefully keeping people from breaking the law. I mean, that's the public protection part. But it doesn't stop people from committing crimes. It didn't stop in August of 2003 the guy on electronic monitoring in Anchorage for raping a 17-year-old. Doesn't stop you from selling drugs out of your house. I mean, you're in compliance with your ankle monitoring situation. In general, as you think of ankle monitoring, it's not a panacea, it's a tool. So.
Thank you very much. We have run out of time today. So our next meeting is Monday. We're not going to pass this bill out today. Representative Wilson, you've heard a lot of the testimony and the discussion, so I suspect you'll be working on this bill with a number of members of the committee and Mr. Svodny and so forth. And let me know when it might be in a form that we're ready to discuss it again. And we will be meeting. I'm going to hold public testimony open because I'm expecting that the next time that the bill may be in a substantially different form and people may want to continue to testify. So our next meeting is going to be Monday, same time, same place. And with that, we are gaveling out.